Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, friends, welcome back. Today, this show is brought to you by the National Conference on Youth Ministries, which will be held in Colorado Springs the week of January 4th through January 7th. This is a conference for youth ministers and youth workers put on by youth ministers and youth workers. Now, along with hearing from veteran youth workers in the trenches of youth ministry, just like you, you will also be able to hear from speakers who are friends of this podcast. Friends like Randy Harris, Josh Ross, Jonathan Storman, and Nadia Bowles Weber. Now, you can find out more about the schedule, make your hotel reservations, and register for the conference at the NCYM website, which is ncym.org. Make your plans quickly to take advantage of the early bird rate, which ends October 12th. You'll be able to save $55 off the full price of the conference. So make sure you go sign up before October 12th. That's it. All right. You're about to hear a conversation with my new friend, Diana Butler Bass. It'll be fun. That's it. That's it. So enjoy. Let me stop recording this. But I'm doing it on my phone, so it's still going. Now I'm going to stop it. Here we go. Here's the podcast.
All right, friends, welcome back to the show. Today I am honored to have on the phone with me from Alexandria, Virginia, Dr. Diana Butler Bass. How are you, ma'am?
I'm doing really well, Luke. It's a nice fall day here in Northern Virginia, and the Pope just arrived.
Wow.
So it's a big week in D.C.
Do you think he arrived because he knows that advanced copies of your book is available?
I would like to think that he came to the United States just to get a copy of Grounded, because if he reads it, I think he would like it.
I think he would, too. I think everyone would like it if they read it. Now, I should warn you, today I just started a new job yesterday, and so if someone interrupts us, I should have said this before we started, but if someone interrupts us, then I'm going to have to put on my preacher hat on and yell at someone, okay? So let me just warn you.
Well, that would be very exciting. I don't think that's ever happened in an interview before, and I'm kind of looking forward to it.
You just got off the phone with our friends at the Religious News Service, right?
I did.
Who were you talking to?
The writer from Religion News Service was Jennifer Price.
Okay.
And she's out of Texas. And she had just read my new book, too, and it was wonderful. She comes much more from an evangelical tradition, and it was an honor that she liked it. And we had a great conversation about God and the world.
Good. Well, this is two Texans back to back. So I don't know.
Oh, that's right. You're from Austin. Yeah. She lives in Victoria.
Yeah, that's a little bit more south of me, I believe. But I don't know what you did. You clearly said your prayers this morning, because talking to two Texans is a pretty great day in my book.
Well, actually, most people don't know this, but I am married to Texas.
Really?
My husband's family were Texans before my mother-in-law belonged to Daughters of the Texas Republic.
Wow.
And my husband's father's family founded the first bank in Denton.
I used to live in Denton until like 2 days ago. I just moved down to Austin from
Denton. Oh my gosh. Well, that's my husband's family, and they were in Texas like in the late 1850s. They were in Texas during the Civil War.
You know what? I was reading your book, and I thought, okay, this is a smart person. Maybe it's because she's got a PhD from Duke. Maybe because she's written for a bunch of stuff, Washington Post, Huffington Post. But then it's not that. It's that you're married to a true Texan.
I am.
Where the erudition comes from. My dad's from Dallas, and my mom is actually from just, I think it's west of you in Fairfax.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, we're probably kin somewhere along the line. Because everybody's related.
We're basically the same person. You're a Virginia person married to a Texan. My dad's a Texan married to a Virginia person. We're family. Let's just do that. We're basically family. Okay. So your book came in the mail recently. The title is Grounded. And I'm reading your book, and I'm enjoying it, having a good time reading it. And so I got the feel in the beginning that you kind of were like, now tell me if I'm wrong. I like to just tell people what they're thinking, because I'm going to just do that. I got the feeling what you're thinking is, hey, I'm one of these people that finds God in nature, and I'm sick of people saying that there's something wrong with this. And so I'm going to kind of write a book defending my position. And I'm still a Christian. Were we going with something along those that line?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's close.
Close.
You know, for the last 10 years, I've been writing books about churches. Mm-hmm. And I've worked, you know, with every major denomination in the United States, except, of course, the Southern Baptists. They haven't really liked my stuff very much.
I'm sorry.
But I know. They're very cool Southern Baptists, but, you know, that poor denomination's got some stuff going on. But I work with a lot of the other ones.
Okay.
And, you know, I've worked with congregations literally all over North America.
All over?
Yes, all over North America. And it's been intriguing because I've heard a lot of anxiety that's been growing among church people about the spiritual but not religious, and a lot of worry about how, oh, my kids have left church, and, you know, they go out hiking on Sunday morning and this, that, and the other thing. And people in church seem to look at all of this as competition, you know, and I've heard pastors say that people who say they're spiritual but not religious, et cetera, are lazy, or they don't want to get involved, or they don't like other human beings, or they're all into individualism. And I just don't think that that's entirely true. So, you know, I set out out of my own experience, as a churchgoer and as a person who knows so much about church, to explore the world around me a bit more from the perspective of a person who doesn't always just find God in the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to ask the question
again. Okay, so we had a little bit of technical difficulties. I think we need a little bit more Wi-Fi at my new job, or I need to turn my computer on correctly, probably that. But you cut off, and you were saying you kind of, people have been critiquing those who find God in nature, and so you begin to ask yourself a question about something, and then you cut off there.
Well, what a dramatic place to cut.
The suspense was killing me. I was like, what is the question? I don't know.
Well, I just began to wonder, you know, what do people really mean, or what do people really experience when they say they find God in nature? And so I decided to try to pay attention to the world that way, and open my heart to finding God outside of the church building. So where is God when we talk about nature, and where is God when we talk about our neighbor? Because that's the other place where so many people find God. They find God
in neighbor,
you know, in the presence of other people. And so that's what Grounded winds up being about. It's about where is God through nature and neighbor.
Yeah.
So I don't really understand myself to be spiritual but not religious. If, you know, you gave me the little quiz, I'd say I was spiritual and religious. I go to church. I go to church. You know, I'm part of the Christian tradition, and it matters to me. I celebrate it. I practice it. But I also do think that sort of the new spiritual questions and the new spiritual voices that are all around us have a lot to contribute to the way that the church probably should be engaging the world today.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm wrestling with this, the idea of experiencing God in nature, and you tell a story, you're in California somewhere and you're on the beach and you have this moment, you're like you start crying and you're connecting, you know, where you are, the presence all around you. And I feel like a lot of us like have that. Like I can think of a moment when I was in Southern California, Laguna Beach, a couple of years ago. And it was just like that morning, I just got done with the run and I was looking, and it just seemed like a really majestic moment. And I think a lot of us have had these moments, but it seems like there's different perspectives on that. Cause I'm guessing that I'm a couple years younger than you. I'm not sure exactly, nor am I going to ask you how old you are. But my generation, it seems like we experience God in nature, but it seems like the generation before, there was a debate over if you did or didn't. Do you think that's fair to say? Like, you think the younger generation is kind of like, yeah, of course we experience God there.
You know, I have a daughter who is 17, and her most sort of dramatic spiritual experiences have been out hiking. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can know how old I am. I'm in my 50s, and I grew up in the 1960s and early 1970s, and I was an urban kid.
Yeah.
And kind of in mid 20th century America, the place where, you know, I was when I was a little girl, is that it was a city culture. You know, think Mad Men, you know, sort
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Yeah.
It's all about urban life, and people were turning away from nature and the cities, except for eventually sort of the hippie movement and the Jesus movement embraced nature. But that was part of what was called then the counterculture. You know, it was because it was counter to the main culture, and the main culture was about urban life. And
yeah.
So the power of nature has been, you know, a thread in American spirituality for the last two centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of is a thread that either comes to the fore or sort of slips to the background.
Hmm.
And in the 20th century, it wasn't the dominant story. But now I think it is becoming the dominant story. And so to me, that's pretty exciting. It's exciting to see my millennial daughter, you know, just if she wants to have, you know, sort of spiritual experience, she doesn't go necessarily to church. She goes out hiking, and that's where she really, really meets God. And I think that that's wonderful, and I think that it's something that the church has to celebrate and pick up on and know how to work with and not see it as competition.
Because so many churches have a tendency to see that as competition. It's either you come in here inside our walls and you hear it in a sermon or music or whatever, or you have to go out there. How do you move past that, you know, dualistic thinking and saying we can be a church who celebrates that God is outside of these walls without like reverting back to that competitive attitude?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I hope that people will take me seriously and engage some of the things that I wrote, because the argument I was trying to make in Grounded is that the earth is part of the incarnation, that the earth is the body of God. And it's a little bit like in the 1940s, I think, the book was written in, Dorothy Sayers, who was a very famous mystery writer,
mm-hmm.
Wrote an essay on the Trinity, and she talked about how the Trinity was best understood as God was the artist, and the act of painting, and then the world is the art.
Hmm.
So artist, the act of artistic expression, and art. And so I thought, when I first read that, I thought, that's really interesting. You know, is that how can you separate an artist from his or her art?
Mm-hmm.
You really can't. Full thing about the Trinity, but it also came to mind again to me as I was writing this book, because if we think about God as creator, God ever really truly be separated from the creation?
Yeah. And so in the book, you make the distinction between what I think some people would probably hear and go, is that pantheism, which, you know, we learned in, you know, Sunday school or whatever, that it's that's wrong. But you're pointing to another alternative where God is in all things, not just that God is all things. Right. Can you clarify that?
Right. I talk about, and very briefly, I try it so hard and grounded not to use very much technical theology language, because I really want it to be a book about nature and neighbor and
yeah.
God's spirit that anybody can go into Barnes & Noble and pick up and say, hey, yeah, this is my experience. But this one technical word that I do use is panentheism. And that's like pantheism, except you stick a little syllable, E-N, between the pan and the theism, and so you get panentheism. And what that means is that God is with, or God is in all things, rather than God is all things. And so the difference is, in pantheism, which Christianity has, and Judaism and Islam, have all had a horror of for the last, you know, thousands of years, but and I'm not even sure it's a really well-placed horror, but it is the tradition that they reject the idea that God is the tree. That's what pantheism is. Mm-hmm. God is the tree, and the tree is God. Panentheism says God is with the tree, and the tree is with God. And it's a very subtle distinction, but it is also, I think, a theological position that works really beautifully. And it's one that is a position that many of the mystics in all of these great world religions have held to.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to take that idea, God is with all things and all things are with God, and unpack that in a really lively way in our cultural setting today.
Yeah, yeah. And so you say, you know, you're finding God in creation, and we'll get to neighbor in a second, but let's say on creation. So you're seeing God in creation, and, you know, this morning I'm staying at my in-law's place north of Austin. It's in the country, and there are like a bunch of deer that are running around the backyard, and I'm doing my breakfast and seeing, and it's like, yeah, of course I see God right here. It's beautiful. And you talk about your beach experience in the book, and everyone kind of has those moments, but it seems like in the incarnation, like Jesus, we see in death, burial, and resurrection that it's not just in like the beautiful, like picturesque moments that you find God, but like God is in like the worst of all things, of death. And it's like the Elie Wiesel thing of God is on the gallows, like God is on the cross, God is in the suffering. And how do you reconcile the idea that, okay, God is in the beautiful moments of creation, but in the Jesus story, God is in death as well?
Well, that's all part of it. I mean, that's the most, to me, in some senses, that's the most interesting thing about the natural world. And one of the things that I've really learned, this city girl has actually gone out now and, you know, spent time in the wilderness and cabins and rustic places in Wyoming and gone hiking with my kid and walks along the Potomac River every day. So I've taught myself to be involved with nature, which has been really important for my soul. And nature, of course, is not just romantically perfect. It is beautiful, like with the sunset or the sunrise. Mm-hmm. It is troubled, because mostly we have made it troubled. It's suffering because of human action. And it also has within it the same kinds of things that any other form of, any other organic system of life has, and that is life and death and new life.
Yeah.
And it's all part of a web of interrelatedness. And so I think that, you know, I think some of the things probably the church has been reacting against is that sort of hyper-romanticized version of nature. Whereas if we understand nature in all of those three guises, the breathless beauty, like I experienced on the beach that I write about, but also I write about, you know, garbage gyras in the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And why we need to pay attention to that. You know, if we believe that Christ is the living water, if we believe Jesus offers living water, well, we've really, really, really messed up the water.
Yeah.
You know? And so we should be attending to that living water.
Yeah.
Because that reminds us of the actual sort of physical incarnation of God in Christ. And so that's one of the things I try to do, is just kind of sort through those three different things. And then also the problem of suffering is that God is with nature as nature itself suffers.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And so that's, I hope that I haven't presented a kind of just, oh yeah, right, just go out and look at the beautiful trees and everything will be cool. But I hope it's a deeper spiritual vision of nature.
Of course, of course. And I love the thing you just referenced about the trash in the Pacific, where, what was it, CNN that was covering the missing plane saga, or tragedy. It was a tragedy. Obviously, people lost their lives in it. And they're like, oh, that might be it right there. No, just a bunch of trash that we've got in the ocean that's all compiled together. Eh, that's nice. You know, so clearly, like, that's not a good thing at all.
Right. That was not a good thing at all. You know, of course, the plane crash is terrible. Mm-hmm. The loss of life is terrible. That's always a horrible thing. But I was really just so taken by the fact that it was like, oh, yeah, trash. And I thought to myself, they're in the middle of nowhere on planet Earth, and there's piles of trash that are so big they can think that it's a wrecked airplane.
Yeah.
You know, or and then of course, you know, if you take the time to learn about that, there are piles of trash that are so big floating around in the Pacific Ocean that they're the size of islands. Hmm. And that trash consists of things, you know, mostly plastic bottles, but all kinds of other junk too that we just sort of carelessly toss into our, you know, local street, and it makes its way halfway across the world so that it can be mistaken for a plane on CNN. And to me, that the thoughtlessness of that is really kind of appalling. When water is one of the most beautiful images for spiritual life that is presented across all of the world's religions. And so, you know, we need to pay attention to the presence of God with dirt and with water and in the air that's all around us. And if we know that those things are spiritual, not just, you know, oh, yeah, that happens to be the water, but that's also a sacred location where God is present, well, it might just motivate us to take better care of it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we talked about God and creation. The other part was talking about God in your neighbor.
Right.
Now, is that all neighbors or just the neighbor you really like?
No, it's all neighbors, and it's really hard.
Yeah. See, I can see God in, like, my good neighbors because they're great. And then the other ones, that's a little bit more of a challenge.
Yeah, well, you know, I have a neighbor. I think he'll probably become famous as I talk about this book. I didn't write about him because I didn't want it in print, but there's a guy who lives right next door to me. Oh, he has a leaf blower and a motorcycle and a snow blower, and he is the noisiest neighbor you can possibly imagine, and it makes me crazy. My husband always says that he's been put there just to remind me of the great command. Love your neighbor as yourself, you know. But, it's easy to love neighbors we like, but it's harder to really wrestle with that command of loving our neighbor
the,
as ourselves.
The religious leader who came up and said, tell me exactly who my neighbor is. That guy, I really can commiserate with him with some of my neighbors in the past. Like, I know why you want to ask that question. Who do I really have to love? Because not all of them are great. But, okay, so we're...
Yeah, you know, and the sad thing is about that question that the lawyer asked Jesus is that, you know, our religious traditions have tried to oftentimes limit who's really our neighbor. Mm-hmm. So the religious tradition teaches this grand thing about loving our neighbors, but then you look through the history of each one of our religions and it says, well, you know, those people really don't count as your neighbors, you know.
Yeah.
And Christianity has been great about limiting who is really a neighbor, you know, despite that amazing teaching by Jesus. And so we can't afford those limits anymore.
Yeah. I don't know if
the planet's too small.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with our Jewish friend's take on the A.J. Levine, but her take on that story is, like, the Good Samaritan is, like, that's the person you'd least want to be there. Like, probably, if we're reading it today, it'd probably be some extremist, like a Muslim extremist, and that's who Jesus is saying, that's who your neighbor is. So, Jesus' take, it's pretty hard. Now, in the book, one of the things that you make reference of is that we struggle with doing neighbors now. It's not the easiest thing. And so the challenge we have is taking individuals and creating neighbors. So why do you think it's so hard for us to move from individuals into neighbors these days?
I personally think a lot of it has to do with fear. Is that for some reason, I think when you have a country that's really big, or we have all these global connections and we can see basically and almost into the living room of half the houses on the planet, you know, all of a sudden the neighborhood has sort of exploded and it's just full of people and you don't really know all the time who to trust.
Yeah.
And so you don't know who to trust, well, then you begin to be suspicious. And if you're suspicious, that quickly mutates into fear. And so then you close your door and you lock your door and you cut yourself off from your neighbor. And so I think it has to do with the size of the population. I think it has to do with technology, you know, just that we're now all connected. And it's like, well, you know, lots of people seem nice enough, but who really knows, you know, what what's lurking next door. And so I do think that our culture is, it inhibits neighborly relations. And so I don't blame that on us as individuals. I think that's just kind of a natural human reaction.
Yeah.
But I do also think it's a natural human reaction that our spiritual traditions ask us to overcome, at least at some level. You know, we have to be wise about how far sometimes we open our door, but we also have to practice hospitality, and we do have to try to trust that God is present in the people around us as well.
Yeah.
And that those people, you know, don't want to die, you know, and those people don't want to hurt us, and those people want a good life as much as we do.
Yeah. So one of the takes on, I forget where I heard this from, but someone was making the theory as to why there are so many shows about serial killers these days is because behind that is this fear that we have of the people near us, that they could be doing some terrible things and we never knew it. And so the person who was telling the story was saying that there are more, you know, serial killers on TV now than there ever have actually been in, you know, history, or I don't know how true that is, but like the fear behind that is like there are a lot of people who are right around us that we know very little about. And so we have this fear, like we don't want to be too close to people. And you quote, I guess it was Frost's poem about the mending wall.
The fence.
The fence. Yeah. And so you, I don't know if it was your line or his line, but there's something about, you know, we always are going to have fences, but good fences have gates. And you say,
right,
like, hospitality is what that gate is that we've got to be able to open up, welcome people in. Nouwen's language, which you quoted, was turning hostility into hospitality, which is a great line. Well done, Henry. And, like, we have to be able to open up doors and have this hospitable attitude towards others, and that's how we see God around us. But there is, like, human nature. Like I was saying, that we're apprehensive about the stranger. So how do you think we can move past that? What is the way to do that?
Well, I do think that a big part of that is really truly understanding that Jesus is in that stranger, that God is, and if you're not a Christian, of course, that God is in that stranger, you know, and that we are all human beings, that we are all connected, that ultimately we are all from the same family, and that there are things about humans that we all have the same desires. You know, I'm looking at all these pictures of these poor people piling out of the Middle East, you know, Muslims and Christians both, who are fleeing, you know, because their towns are being destroyed, their families are being murdered, there are these horrible people who have, you know, who have taken over, you know, and they're trying to get to safety. And they're trying to get to safety not because they want to destroy Western culture and not because they want Christians to all be killed by Muslims. You know, that's exactly the opposite of the thing that they want. They want the same thing that everybody wants, a place where they can raise a family in safety and have the best for their children and not have to fear for their lives, and that they can have a meal to eat. Yeah. You know, and isn't that really true for every one of us on the planet? I mean, there's this percentage of people who are probably, you know, not mentally healthy and that they want some other things. And those are the people we do have to worry about. But that's really a small percentage of the population compared to everybody else. And so I think we kind of have to keep seeing both our own humanity in our neighbor, in the stranger's face, and we also have to keep seeing the face of God in our, in the stranger's face. And if we can just, that's what our spiritual traditions hold us to, that higher vision of the stranger. And that's one of the reasons why I think actually that these religions are kind of important right now, you know, that they do hold us to that higher ethic.
Yeah. Okay, so you had the interesting thing early in the book about how
Can I tell you one story really quickly, though?
Oh, I like stories. You know, yeah, tell me a story.
Well, you know, that in the neighbor chapter that I write, we did have a serial killer who killed one of our neighbors.
That was a serial killer who did that? You didn't spell out the details. Thankfully.
Well, yeah, I didn't spell out the details because the trial has not happened yet. So he is an alleged serial killer. But the fellow who killed my neighbor, it is a man by the name of Jesse Matthew, and he's already been found guilty of a rape and attempted murder of a woman in Fairfax County in 2005, and he's in jail for that. And the state of Virginia is holding him responsible for the murder of both my neighbor and another young woman. And that trial is going to be, I guess, in July next year. So he is alleged a serial killer. And you know, that happened in my neighborhood. And that happened to a girl who went to my daughter's high school. And of all people on the planet, you know, I mean, I should be one of those people who's terrified of the stranger.
Yes.
And I preach a sermon about this. And I was talking about the young girl who was murdered and what it did to our neighborhood and how painful it was. And in the middle of the sermon, I stopped and I said, and you know what, Jesse Matthew, and that's the person who's alleged to have killed Hannah, my neighbor, I said, you know what, he's my neighbor too. And I just said in the middle of the sermon, and that's the bitch of it.
Hmm.
And the whole congregation started crying. Because we all knew that was true, is that it was easy to love the beautiful young girl who was killed. But the truth of it is even the person who disturbed the peace of our neighborhood who killed her, he's our neighbor too. And what the heck does that mean? And that is what Christianity is about.
Yeah.
That is what it means to love your neighbor, is to try to figure out what that implies for the world today. And if we can figure that out, we're going to be a lot further down the road towards living in a world that is safe. If we can figure out what it means to even love ISIS, even love the serial killer, even love the neighbor with the leaf blower at 3 a.m. You know, those are the people we need to learn to figure out what does it mean to love them.
Yeah, well, first of all, I like that you categorize all those together: leaf blower, ISIS, serial killer. I appreciate it. I know exactly what you think about that guy now. But okay, so you're saying that like the serial killer is your neighbor when Hannah, and this is terrible to say, but you have a 17-year-old daughter too. I have 3 daughters, and it's easy in that situation for me, as not as a pastor but as a father, just to say, no, I want to build bigger gates or build bigger walls, protect myself from others because I don't want that happening to me. There's no way. I mean, the yellow bows, I guess, ribbons that everyone hung around, and I can't imagine if that was for my daughter. And to say that the person who did that is your neighbor. And I loved how you said that's ultimately the heart of what Christianity, like that's the real beauty of the Jesus story.
Right.
And I don't know if, I hope one day I can get to that place. I don't know if I'm there right now, to be honest.
Well, you know, I mean, I can say that, and I felt it certainly
in that moment,
vicariously, you know, because of this happened in my neighborhood to my neighbor.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, that the girl who was killed went to my daughter's school, and, you know, I saw my daughter's face so strongly in the face of the girl who lost her life. I mean, my empathy, I think I've experienced empathy like that. But that was also the flip side of it was in the middle of that sermon, when all of a sudden it was literally my grandmother, who passed away before I was born, was a Pentecostal lay preacher. And that would have been the moment that she called conviction.
Hmm.
You know, so there I am preaching the sermon about, you know, this beautiful neighbor that had died. And it was literally in the middle of the sermon that I got convicted that the murderer is our neighbor too.
Wow. So now, you weren't planning to say that.
No, I was not planning on saying that. That literally just flew out of my mouth. And that's really scary when that happens when you're preaching a sermon.
That is so true. That is very terrifying.
It is, because then you know that it doesn't really come from you. You know, it came from me, but it was a place that was so deep that I couldn't even get to it, except for some reason it happened in the setting of preaching in community with that group of people that I was preaching for. And, you know, ever since I said it, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, that's, and I look at the news and I just go, how can you do that? You know, how, I don't know, but I do know that that's what we're supposed to be. That's what Jesus was really truly talking about. And if I want to live a life in imitation to Jesus, so that's what I at least have to strive for or recognize how hard it is to get there.
Yeah. I think they would have to be the Holy Spirit that would speak through me for me to say something like that. That's terrifying. Wow. That that's the hard part of truly doing neighboring. It's that you have that around you, and that's the problem of it.
And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be sensible. You know, I mean, because the other part of Scripture, of course, is about honoring. You know. Honoring other human beings, about seeing God embodied in all people. I mean, in the failure of the serial killer is that he, in this case, did not see the humanity of that young girl, and that he chose, for whatever reason, not to see it, and he violated that humanity just out of his own desire or his own illness or whatever it is. And so that doesn't let him off the hook, because there are these other things in scriptures too. It's not just all, you know, like I said, it's not just all sunshine and flowers. It is this sort of robust vision of our neighbor, that our neighbor is fully human, is fully our brother and sister, is fully the icon of God, is fully the carrier of God's love and spirit. And we cannot violate that. We are called to treasure that and honor that and never violate it. And so when a person chooses to violate it, when they become the, I've frequently referred to this situation with the guy who was the alleged murderer. I have to keep saying alleged so I don't get in trouble. But, you know, with the guy who was the alleged murderer is that he violated that principle, which is really kind of the fundamental principle of neighborly relationships, is yeah. being able to see God in one another. But that still doesn't make him any less a human being.
Yeah.
Who equally deserves my ability to see him as being fully human, even when he has chosen to violate that principle in other people. And so there is a fullness there, and there is also a fullness of the web that we live in and inhabit together. And it has mutual responsibilities and mutual senses of justice and love. And so, you know, to me, if we can actually build neighborhoods that at least take that seriously, and it might just go a little further to help us to be able to trust one another and also to be able to create a kind of environment where hospitality can be more fully practiced.
Hmm.
So that's one of the things I hope our churches can really engage.
Yeah, and it should be. And I love that, I mean, that's who Jesus calls us to be. That's what, you know, God wants us to be. And I love how I think you have a poster set in your office about all the different world religions that have some form of do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And it's like,
I do. I'm looking at it right when you're talking to
me.
Oh,
good. Nice. And so like it's this universal principle that we realize throughout different, you know, religions that this ultimately is how we need to interact with one another. It's the only way to make this work. And yeah, that's the rub for all of us. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. Okay, I want to change gears.
Yeah, great. Wonderful.
Okay,
I'm ready to move on.
Okay, I want to talk about the way that people talk about God, especially in tragedies like this. And you talked about that the question now is different than it was before. Previously, people were asking, you know, what was God's purpose for this? And so there's a tragedy like what happened with Hannah in your community, and you go, like, what is God's purpose for that? And now the question isn't purpose, but location. Where is God in that? Why do you think that question has changed today?
I think it just is related to, you know, the fact that people, well, it's a different cultural time. You know, in the Middle Ages, there was, or the Reformation, or even earlier phases in American history, you know, people just assumed that there was this universe that was structured where God lived in heaven and we were here on earth, and then there was the possibility of all of us after we died of being separated from God in a place called hell. And so there's this, what I call the three-tiered universe. And that's, you know, you can find that in philosophy and poetry, and Dante spins that out, and, you know, it's a pretty common way of understanding the way the structure, the universe is structured. And what's happened over the last 100 years or so is that that three-tiered universe has basically disappeared. There are people who still believe in it, but for the most part, the structure of the universe has flattened philosophically. And so, like Rob Bell, for example, I mean, he got in huge trouble when he wrote a book about how there is no hell. Well, you know, all he was doing was reporting the news. Mm. You know, is that philosophically, the old three-tiered structure of the universe, philosophers and scientists and lots of people, cosmologists, have gotten rid of that structure and now say, you know, we live in a universe that is very closely connected. Some people use the language of a web to talk about it. I read this amazing book by a physicist earlier this year that talks about the circle of the universe, and essentially that that all the things that we used to think about as sort of the tiers of the universe, the heavens, the surface of the earth, and what is under the earth, consist together of all these complex sort of mini universes within each one of them, all of which are completely interdependent on all of the other universes, both above and below them. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, the whole structure of the universe, what we understand as the structure of the universe, is changing. And so I talk about it having flattened, that what we understand now is that we live in the midst of a web, and that web is profoundly earthly. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in the question of what does that mean? You know, yeah. In the old sort of, you know, structure of things, we used to think about, oh, we're going to go die and see Jesus in heaven, and you know, we want to escape the fires of hell. But, you know, if the whole nature of how we understand the universe has changed, well, what does that really mean? Where is God? Mm-hmm. And I think that you can think about that from the scientific perspective, which clearly a lot of people are. It's probably one of the reasons why atheism is growing, is that as more and more people understand the structure of the universe as physics is now understanding it, the old God doesn't really kind of work. Mm-hmm. And so they say, where is God? Well, my atheist friends say, well, there is no God. That's a remnant of the old universe. And I, to them, I say, no, maybe God is just differently located. And so for me, I've really struggled with this and tried to think through it myself. Where is God? And what is that going to mean for the beautiful, amazing, you know, sort of stories that I love and that we still bear, the stories of Jesus, the stories of the cross, the stories of the resurrection, the stories of Christmas, the stories of the miracles. If God is differently located, how do we read that, all those stories? And I think about that, and I go, what an exciting time we live in, is that we live in a time in which people are rethinking the very nature of reality. And if indeed the Christian story ever was true, the Christian story can be retold in this new context, and it can be told in a way that is faithful and beautiful and true. And so that's some of the stuff that I try to do, and I get very, you know, obviously, I hope you can hear my voice. I get very excited about that, you know, mm-hmm. and I think of my job as being a sort of a spiritual storyteller for a new time. And my spiritual stories happen to come out of these really old stories that you find in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, and I'm trying to make them make sense in this new place.
That's good. That's good. And I love how you were incorporating science, and you made a point in the book about how that you were surprised that they're asking. You were at some conference and they ask you questions about physics, and you're surprised they're asking you those questions, and then you realize that that people aren't seeing faith and science as enemies. And your work, obviously, along with plenty of other people, is helping move that forward where they don't have to think of, oh, if I'm going to buy into science, that means I have to give up on religion. But you can bring faith and religion together, right? And
yeah. So, I hope that that is. I think it's the case, and I hope many, many more people experience that as the case.
Yeah, and I think people are getting there. So anyway, let's thank you for your time, Grounded. I enjoyed reading the book. Thank you for writing it. Appreciate it. And
great.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, it's a joy to talk about a new book. You know, I haven't had this many conversations yet about it, and you're one of the first people to read it that didn't read it as I was writing it, and so it's really wonderful to hear such a warm and positive response to it. And I hope that, people will like it. I hope people will love it, actually.
Yes. And so what I hear you saying is this is your favorite interview you've ever done. That's what I heard you saying. Yeah,
absolutely. This is my favorite interview I've ever done about Grounded.
This afternoon. Outstanding. Hey, Diana, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Luke. And thanks for all that you do. It's a great thing to be able to have a conversation with good readers. And you get to have conversations with great writers all the time. What a wonderful job. I wish you luck in your new position.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun to get to talk to people like you. And so thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.